A Journey in Search of Christmas by Owen Wister. The governor descended the steps of the Capitol slowly and with pauses, lifting a list frequently to his eye. His gait grew absent as he recurred now to his jottings with a slight pain at their number. They were the names of his friends' children to whom his excellent heart moved him to give Christmas presents. He had put this off until the latest day, and now he was setting forth to do the whole thing at a blow, entirely planless among the guns and rocking horses that would presently surround him. As he reached the highway, he heard himself familiarly addressed from a distance and, turning, saw four sons of the alkali jogging into town from the plain. One who had shouted to him galloped out from the others and once again greeted him with a hilarious, "Hello, Doc!" Governor Barker, M.D., seeing Mr. McLean unexpectedly after several years, hailed the horseman with frank and lively pleasure and, inquiring who might be the other riders behind, was told that they were Shorty, Chalkeye, and Dollar Bill, come for Christmas. "And dandies to hit town with," Mr. McLean added. "Red hot!"
"I am acquainted with them," assented His Excellency.
"We've been riding trail for 12 weeks, making our beds down anywheres and eating the same old chuck every day. We're sick of moonlight and cow dung, and we're healed for a big time."
"Call on me when you're ready for bromides and sulfates."
"I ain't box-headed no more. I've got maturity, Doc, and I'm a heap older than them hospital days when I bust my leg on you. 3 or 4 glasses and quit. That's my rule."
"That's your rule, too?" inquired the governor of Shorty, Chalkeye, and Dollar Bill. These gentlemen of the saddle were sitting quite expressionless upon their horses.
"We ain't talking. We're waiting," observed Chalkeye, and the three cynics smiled amiably.
"Well, Doc, see you again," said Mr. McLean.
He turned to accompany his brother cowpunchers, but in that particular moment, fate descended, or came up from whatever place she dwells in, and entered the body of the unsuspecting governor.
"What's your hurry? Come along with me."
"Where are you going?"
"Christmasin'."
"Well, I've got to feed my horse." "Christmasin', you say?"
"Yes, I'm buying toys."
"Toys? You? What for?"
"Oh, some kids."
"Yourn?"
"Not mine, I'm happy to say. My friends keep marrying and settling, and their kids call me uncle and climb around and bother, and I forget their names and think it's a girl, and the mother gets mad. Why, if I didn't remember these little folks at Christmas, they'd be wondering. Not the kids. They just break your toys and don't notice. But the mother would wonder. What's the matter with Dr. Barker? Has Governor Barker gone back on us? That's where the strain comes, you see. 2 sets of acquaintances. Grateful patients and loyal voters. And I've got to keep solid with both outfits, especially the wives and mothers. They're the people. So it's drums and dolls and sheep on wheels and games and monkeys on a stick. And the sales lady shows you a mechanical bear and it costs too much. And you forget whether the judge's second girl is Nellie or Susie and... Well, I'm just in for my annual circus this afternoon. You're in luck. Christmas don't trouble a chap fixed like you."
"A chap fixed like you?"
The cowpuncher said it slowly to himself.
"No, sure."
He seemed to be watching Shorty and Chalkeye and Dollar Bill going down the road.
"That's a new idea. Christmas."
"Comes once a year pretty regular," remarked the prosperous governor. "Seems often when you pay the bill."
"I haven't made a Christmas gift, not for Lord, it's 100 years, I guess. I don't know anybody that has any right to look for such a thing from me."
This was indeed a new idea, and it did not stop the chill that was spreading in his heart.
"Gee whiz," said Barker briskly. "There goes 12 o'clock. I've got to make a start. Sorry you can't come and help me. Goodbye."
His Excellency left the rider sitting motionless, and forgot him at once as he hastened upon his journey to the shops. The Nellies and Susies pervaded his mind, and he struggled with the presentiment that in a day or two he would recall some omitted and wretchedly important job.
Quick hoofbeats made him look up, and Mr. McLean passed like a wind. The governor absently watched him go and rejoicingly remembered one more name and wrote it as he walked. In a few minutes, he had come to the shops and met face to face with Mr. McLean.
"The boys are seeing after my horse, and I've got to meet 'em sharp at one. I'd like to, Doc, I'd like just for a while to watch you getting them monkeys, you know."
Picture of a cowpuncher and himself discussing a couple of dolls rose nimbly in Barker's mental eye, and it was with an imperfect honesty that he said, "You'll help me a heap."
"Thank you."
Wyoming's chief executive now laid a hand on Len's tall shoulder and drew him among the petticoats and toys. Christmas filled the windows, and Christmas stirred in mankind. Cheyenne was flocking together, neighbor to think of neighbor, and every one to remember the children. Len saw them hurry and smile among the paper fairies. This brotherhood swam and beamed before the cowpuncher's brooding eyes, and in his ears the greeting of the season sang. Two or three came by whose purses must have been slender, and when one plain man dropped a word about both ends meeting, and the woman with him laid a hand on his arm, saying that his children must not feel this year was different, Len made a step toward them. There were hours and spots where he could readily have descended upon them. But the people brushed by him, scarcely more than if he'd been a spirit looking on from the helpless dead. And so he was locked outside with his impulses. Barker had long parted from him, immersed in choosing and rejecting, and now he was ready to go on to the next place and turn to beckon McLean. He found him beside a life-sized image of Santa Claus, standing as still as the frosty saint.
"He looks livelier than you do. Afraid it's been slow waiting."
"No, no, I guess not. Well, never mind. I've got some real advice to ask you now." At this, Mr. McLean's face grew more alert.
"Say, Doc, what do you want for Christmas that nobody's likely to give you?"
"Big practice. Big enough to interfere with my politics."
"What else? Things in truck, I mean."
"Oh, nothing I'll get. People don't give things much to fellas like me."
"Don't they?
Why, you and Santa Claus weren't putting up any scheme on my stocking."
"Well, I believe you're in earnest. My dear fellow, I don't want you to spend your money on me. I've got plenty, all right. Plenty's not the point. I'll take as many drinks as you please with you. You didn't expect anything from me."
There, of course you didn't.
"Then what are you getting proud about?"
"Here's our shop."
They stepped in from the street to new crowds and counters. "Now," pursued the governor, "this is for a very particular friend of mine. Here they are. Now, which of those do you like best?" They were sets of Tennyson in cases holding little volumes equal in number, but the binding various, and Mr. McLean reached his decision after one look.
"That,"
said he, and laid a large muscular hand upon the Laureate edition. The young lady behind the counter spoke out acidly, and Len pulled the abject hand away. His taste was at one with the governor's, but now they learned that there was a distressing variance in the matter of price.
"I know that Tennyson is what she..."
"Is what's wanted," he muttered, and feeling himself nudged, looked around and saw Len's extended fist, and, grasping the hand, found himself holding a lump of bills. Sheer amazement relaxed him, and the cowpuncher's matted wealth tumbled on the floor in sight of all people. Barker picked it up and gave it back.
"No, no, no, you can't do that."
"I'm obliged, Len."
"Just a loan, Doc, some of it. I'm grass-bellied with spot cash."
The governor at once paid haughtily for Tennyson's expensive works, and the cowpuncher pushed his discountenanced savings back into his clothes. Making haste to leave the book department of this shop, the governor became waggish over Len's concern at being too rich. He suggested to him the list of delinquent taxpayers and the latest census from which to select indigent persons. He had patients, too, whose inveterate pennilessness he could swear cheerfully to.
since you'd want to bolt from your own money.
Yes, I'm a green horse, ain't used to the looks of a $20 bill, and I shy at 'em.
A good woman would have guessed before this the sensitive soul in the blundering body, but Barker saw just the familiar, whimsical, happy-go-lucky McLean of old days, and so he went gaily and innocently on, treading upon holy ground.
I've got it. Give your wife something.
The ruddy cowpuncher grinned. He welcomed the turn which the conversation seemed now to be taking.
If you'll give me her name and address,
said he, with the future entirely in his mind.
Why, Laramie,
said the governor, feigning surprise.
See, Doc, none of 'em ain't married me since I saw you last.
Then she hasn't ridden from Laramie?
Gee whiz, I'll never forget you and Lust that day.
You're talking of his wife, not mine.
And, Doc, I'm going to say a word to you, for I know you've always been my good friend. I'll never forget that day myself, but I don't want to be reminded of it.
I'm a fool, Lynn. I never supposed.
I know you didn't, Doc. It ain't you that's the fool. But I ain't quite the same fool I was before that happened to me, though maybe my actions didn't show to be wiser. I know that there was better luck than a man like me had any call to look for.
The sobered Barker simply said, "Yes, Lynn." He was put to thinking by these words from the unsuspected inner man. Out in the Bowleg country, Lynn McLean had met a woman with thick red cheeks, calling herself by a maiden name, and this was his whole knowledge of her when he took her 50 miles to a magistrate and made her his lawful wife, to the best of his ability and belief. His sagebrush intimates were confident he would never have done it but for a rival. Racing the rival and beating him had swept Mr. McLean past his own intentions, and the marriage was an inadvertence. He just bumped into it before he could pull up, they explained. And this casualty had entertained several hundred square miles of alkali. For the new-made husband, the joke soon died. In the immediate weeks that came upon him, he tasted a bitterness worse than in all his life before, and learned also how deep a woman can sink in baseness. That was a knowledge of which he had lived innocent until this time. But an unexpected first husband named Lusk had appeared one Sunday in the street, prosperous, forgiving, and exceedingly drunk. To the arms of Lusk she went back in the public street, deserting McLean in the presence of Cheyenne, and when Cheyenne saw this, and learned how she had been Mrs. Lusk for 8 long, if intermittent, years, Cheyenne laughed loudly. Lynn McLean laughed too, and went about his business with the necessary kind of joke always ready to shield his hurt spirit. And soon the matter grew stale, seldom raked up in the Bowleg country where Lynn had been at work. So lately he had begun to remember other things besides the smoldering humiliation.
"Is she still with Lusk?"
he asked Barker. Instead of narrating how Mrs. beat Mr. on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and Mr. took his turn the odd days, while the kid Lusk had outlined his opinion of the family by skipping to parts unknown, Barker detailed these incidents more gravely, adding that Laramie believed Mrs. Lusk addicted to opium.
"I don't guess I'll leave my card on him if I strike Laramie. You don't mind my saying I think you're well out of that scrape?"
"Shicks, no. That's all right, Doc. Only, you see now, a man gets tired pretending once in a while." Time had gone while they were in talk, and it was now 1:30, and Mr. McLean late for that long-plotted first square meal. So the friends shook hands, wishing each other Merry Christmas, and the cowpuncher hastened toward his chosen companions through the stirring cheerfulness of the season. Here was Cheyenne, full of holiday for sale, and he with his pockets full of money to buy. And when he thought of Shorty and Chalkeye and Dollar Bill, those dandies to hit a town with, he stepped out with a brisk, false hope. He put on his town clothes after shaving and admiring himself and sat down to the square meal.
He ate away and drank with a robust imitation of enjoyment that took in even himself at first. But the sorrowful process of his spirit went on for all he could do. As he groped for the contentment which he saw around him, he began to feel a distaste for the company of his friends and a shrinking from their lively voices. "I'm celebrating no Christmas with this crowd," said the inner man, and when they had next remembered Lynn McLean in their hilarity, he was gone. Governor Barker, finishing his purchases at 3:30, went to meet a friend come from Evanston. Mr. McLean was at the railway station buying a ticket for Denver.
"Denver? That's what I said. Gee whiz, what are you going to do there? Get good and drunk. Can't you find enough whiskey in Cheyenne? I'm drinking champagne this trip."
The cowpuncher went out on the platform and got aboard, and the train moved off. Barker had walked out, too, in his surprise, and as he stared after the last car, Mr. McLean waved his wide hat defiantly and went inside the door.
"And he says he's got maturity," Barker muttered. "I've known him since 79, and he's kept about 8 years old right along."
The governor was cross and sorry, and presently crosser. His jokes about Lynn's marriage came back to him and put him in a rage with the departed fool.
"Yes, about 8 or 6. He'll wake up about noon tomorrow in a dive without a cent. Then he'll come back on a freight and begin over again.